You're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, and the time is 6 o'clock. Here's a quick look at traffic and weather. There are no accidents reported, and the current temperature is 76 degrees. Skies are clear. Humidity is 91%. There's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 7 a.m. Today's high will be around 92 degrees and low 75 degrees. Winds are calm. Sunrise will be at 6:33 a.m., sunset at 8:22 p.m. Air quality forecast shows ozone may reach moderate levels on the west and northwest side of the Houston area, with highest concentrations in the afternoon and early evening. Ultraviolet index is extreme. Please stay tuned for Thresholds with John Prophet and George Ryder. Their guest is Kirsten Nottelson.
And good morning, Houston. Welcome into Thresholds from KPFT. John Prophet here in the studio. And as Laura mentioned, we'll be bringing George Ryder, your erstwhile in-studio host. He'll be coming in via telephone from his summer home up in upstate New York. I'm happy to say, George Ryder, that I was in upstate, actually western New York last weekend, and it was just as hot as Houston. I think you've been sweltering, too. So with that in mind, we're back in Houston now, and our guest on the broadcast this morning is Kirsten Nottelson, who is the leader of the Hand in Hand Workshops based in Austin. And Kirsten has as her slogan for the workshops, making the world a better place for children, one relationship at a time. Kirsten, good morning, and thank you for joining us here on KPFT.
Good morning, John. Nice to be here.
It's good to have this kind of a thought, making the world better for children, one relationship at a time. So the Hand in Hand Workshops, it seems, has been there to for a few years to help parents learn the job of being parents. I guess it's not really a very much of a natural thing for parents to do.
Well, I think there's parts of it that are natural, and there's parts of it where many of us parents feel lost. You know, that we could use a little support and a little help. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, I think that our society right now is not really set up very well to support parents. We're working on it and it's getting better, but I think we're kind of meant to do it in a supportive environment. And that's what I try to provide with my organization, is support for parents where they need help.
Well, give us a little background on the Hand in Hand Workshop, so we have an idea of how little of the history of the organization and how it actually goes about helping parents.
Well, the history is I was set out to be a teacher in the classroom, and I was a preschool teacher, and I had this wonderful mentor co-teacher that encouraged me to start doing some trainings first for the staff at the preschool, and then we started, you know, branching out, and, well, this is going really well. Let's do some trainings for the parents.
Sure.
And I started doing some in my community, and it just grew from there. And for about 19 years now, I've been working with parents in many different forms, whether that's individual in their home and doing play sessions with families, or teaching to large groups. I'm currently going into some drug treatment facilities and teaching some classes. And, you know, I talk not just about, like, you know, hands-on skills of how you can help your child day-to-day, but also kind of getting a chance to look at your own history, how you were raised, and how that impacts the way that you feel about yourself and the way that you feel about your children and how you interact and how, you know, what triggers you. And I go into preschools and do training for staff there, and I feel like I have the best job in the world, actually. I really, really, really love what I do, and now I do some classes online with folks all over the world at times, so it's really, really exciting.
Well, it sounds like you have your hands full. I have to ask, do you have children of your own?
Yes, I have two boys who are 7 and 13.
The perfect year to sort of exercise the skills you teach, I would imagine.
Every year, I promise you, every year, every day, I'm learning new things. I don't have it all down pat. it's always a learn, you know, just when you think you've got it figured out with children, something changes. And so it's really about learning to be adaptable and pay attention to them and what they're doing, you know, and what they need and who they are. So.
Well, I'd like to also introduce the normal host of the show, George Ryder, who is said on the line coming in from upstate New York, and I know this is a topic, childhood development and parenting, that has been very, very close to George's heart for a long time. When I first joined the show as co-host, the topic we talked about was basically that child rearing. And And I think one thing you alluded to, Kirsten, namely that there's a lot of, all of us as parents have a hard time escaping our own past, our own history, and sometimes that our own history can be the biggest obstacle.
Mm. John, can I be heard?
Absolutely. You're loud and clear.
Yeah. Kirsten, would you say more about what children need and who they are? Because there's tremendous amounts of misunderstanding about that in the culture. I mean, I know in my own experience, I remember thinking about my son as a sort of incompetent adult who needed somehow to be trained to become competent. And I don't think about that in children that way, myself either that way anymore. What's your take on that?
Yeah. Great question. So what we know about babies is that they come out, if something, you know, hasn't gotten in the way in utero or in the birth process, if there hasn't been some traumatic event or injury or something that's interfered with their normal, you know, quote-unquote normal development, babies come into the world. You know, they arrive ready to connect with people. They are looking for us for attention, warmth, love. They're ready to learn. They're ready to love. Their minds are already forming based on their experiences. Their brains are making synaptic connections at an incredibly rapid rate. Every interaction they have, every, you know, eye contact or lack of eye contact, the way that we hold them, those are all creating these synaptic connections, these sort of message links in their brains that are informing the way that they operate in the world. And so the interactions that we have early on with children are very, very critical. In some ways, they are almost as critical as the physical formation. You know, they come out and we check how many fingers do they have, how many toes do they have, both eyes, everything in shape that way. But the neurological forming is almost as important, you know, like what are those interactions like? Because that will shape how they operate through their life. And, you know, how we interact, how we talk to them, hold them, the interactions that happen on a regular basis will become solidified information in their mind. Hmm. And those that don't get used will fall away. So it's, I think you guys have probably heard the term use it or lose it. What gets used sticks around, what doesn't leaves. So what are the interactions that we want to have be used? What they experience is going to inform the way that they react to others, the way they respond to others, the way they feel about themselves, the way that what they believe about the world. They are very curious, very open people as young ones. And as they go into the world, they are naturally, you know, their true nature is to be cooperative and playful, curious, loving. They know how to be flexible. They know how to be adaptable. It's when things get in the way of that that sort of true nature gets sidelined. And something else really important to know is that children are good. They are naturally good. They're not some of these other things that we hear out in society, which are, you know, children are manipulative or, oh, she's mean or they're possessive or grabby or selfish or rude or bad. That's a big one.
Those are learned behaviors is what you're emphasizing here.
Learned behaviors, yep, and they're also a result of getting hurt.
Yeah.
Basically, they're a result of being hurt.
Well, a question for you, Kirsten. This sounds as if part of your workshop topics that you have to address from time to time would be, what do adoptive parents have to deal with when they make the very loving decision to adopt an older child that has perhaps undergone some of the more negative and traumatic effects from birth to at the point their adoptive parents come into the picture? So is there some way a lot of repair work to be done?
Absolutely. Great question. Absolutely. Yeah, we adoptive parents have the challenge of not knowing what the full history is a lot of times. But the work that we do can very much eradicate a lot of the harm that has been done. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes love and it takes warmth. Love, warmth, commitment, willingness to allow those children to have feelings, you know, allow those children to play, allow those children to connect with humans, have consistency, have warmth. And we can often undo a lot of that hurt and early trauma from, you know, the connections and the interactions that we have with our children.
How do you do that, Kirsten,
in their world.
George?
How do you heal the trauma? I mean, even if it's your own child, things happen. How do you undo the damage?
Right, and I want to say that's absolutely true. That our children that we've raised from the moment they were born may have similar upsets and hurts based on their experience. So I need to back up a little bit and say how children's behavior goes off track in the first place. And what happens is that, as I said, they come into the world, they're ready to play, they're relaxed, they're loving, they're warm. And what happens for children's behavior to go off track or for trauma to happen is that something will happen. Either a child will be, it can start as simple as, you're having this loving interaction with a child, you're holding them in your arms, and you're making that lovely googly eye contact we make with infants where they're in the crook of your arm, and that's the distance they can see you. The crook of your arm to your face is the distance newborns can see, and which is incredible. Thank you for that, Mother Nature. And we're looking at them, and they're falling into our eyes, and we're having this lovely interaction, and something as simple as the door bell rings and we set the baby down to go get the door, and this baby doesn't understand what just happened. We were having this lovely interaction here. I had them. They were right with me and they just disappeared, and they don't know we're coming back. They don't understand what a doorbell is yet. And to them, it's sort of in their mind, it sort of registers as an emotional a small emotional emergency. Because we're so hardwired to have that interaction, that's what they're really searching for early on. And so that registers as a small emotional emergency. And usually what would happen is we would come back and make more eye contact with the baby, and they can kind of rest and say, oh, okay, all is well with the world. There is a human being out there taking care of me. I'm safe. So that's kind of some of the early hurts that happen to virtually all children. I don't know anybody that can be completely in eye contact with their child all the time. I don't know that that's necessarily even healthy for a child. So that's like a beginning hurt. But then there's all kinds of other little hurts that happen, either a child being handled roughly, physical hurts, they were dropped, or something scary happening, a jarring loud noise, yelling, as they get out of infancy, if there's regular neglect, either not fed well, when there's lots of hunger and nobody responds, a baby crying for some sort of need and not getting responded to, as they get older, there are more outside influences. You know, a dog in the neighborhood comes and barks really close to their face, and it startles them. And maybe on the playground at school, they're teased or embarrassed or yelled at. If all went well, what would happen is when there was an upset like that, when there was a hurt, you know, a dog comes and barks and screams at a child, the child would naturally make use of our human healing process, which is to cry. You know, when you're startled or you're scared or there's nobody coming, you cry to get the attention, to get that need met. And that is the natural healing process. And if all went well, they would have an adult nearby that would come by and stand by them and allow them to cry, allow the comfort them and let them know, all is well, I'm with you. The child could cry and the healing process would take place and the child would feel better and they would bound on and go on with their life. But when a child is not able to make use of that healing process, shaking when they're scared, crying, trembling, making sounds of their own to undo the hurt, that hurt goes inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of gloms on to their emotional center of their brain, and it doesn't have a chance to release, and it sort of interferes with a little bit of their higher level thinking, their thinking that is, you know, rational, logical, good judgment, having the ability to have impulse control, all those sort of logical, people call it the executive thinking part of their brain. That little by little, hurts that don't get to be healed, those interfere little by little with that sort of thinking. And they cloud our judgment, they cloud our rational thought, they cloud our logic. And that is when behavior goes off track. That's when you see residual results of trauma. And so, if that is the case, when a child has clouded thinking, their behavior's off track, they can't function well, they're either aggressive, unable to pay attention in school, if they can't seem to connect with human beings, they don't make good eye contact, they're quote-unquote misbehaving out in public, and when we try to address them and say, you know, sweetie, you can't do that while we're here, and they can't seem to make that choice and be logical about it, and they can't make their behavior be sort of cooperative and flexible, that's an indication that there's sort of a backlog of these built-up hurts that didn't get to get healed along the way, and that's what we're trying to get at. Not so much changing the behavior up on top. That'll happen if we do the healing on a lower level.
Getting at the hurt behind what's happened. Well, Kirsten, we're going to have to take a very, very quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest this morning on Thresholds is Kirsten Nottelson of the Hand in Hand Workshops. And if you'd like to see some of the information about the Hand in Hand Workshops, they have a website. It is on the World Wide Web, www.handinhandworkshops. That's one word, .com. This is Thresholds, and Laura's standing by the KPFT control room with some up-to-date on the traffic and weather. And Laura, good morning to you.
Good morning, John. Well, there are no accidents right now. There's just one area of slow traffic, and that's on 45, the Gulf Freeway, inbound from Monroe to Broadway. The current temperature is 75 degrees with a few clouds. Humidity is 94%, and there is a slight chance of showers today, probably after 1 p.m. The high temperature today will be around 92 and low around 75 degrees. Now, back to Thresholds.
Thanks, Laura. And I'm John Proffitt, along with George Ryder, and our guest this morning, Kirsten Nottelson from the Hand in Hand Workshops. Kirsten, you were talking about the, the need to deal immediately in as part of the developmental process with healing those frustrations and hurts that, if allowed to build up, can be more and more difficult and more and more difficult part of the child's personality. Am I hearing this correctly?
Yeah, that's a good summing up of it. Yeah, that's
it. One of the things that I'm also curious about is that if we flip it over a little bit, what can parents, you know, from birth to whenever, do to help nurture the infant's development, other than, you know, the reactive healing process you're describing? Are there, I mean, we hear things, as an example, that playing Mozart and letting them listen to classical music can help a child develop. I'm not sure if that's the kind of thing I'm specifically looking at, but are there positive things that parents should be doing?
Absolutely. And, you know, the good news is that it doesn't take rocket science. It doesn't, you know, it's really, we're all capable of what children need to grow and function at a maximum level. And what that is warmth and connection. It's like being there when your child needs you, responding to, you know, being able to kind of tune in and pay attention to what they're interested in, you know, giving them time when you're sort of following their lead in play and working on noticing what makes them laugh and going after that more, you know, that playtime that we do, like in the morning when you're waking up, you know, I kind of remember Saturday mornings being able to run into my parents' bedroom and, you know, climb all over my dad's legs and wrestle with them and snuggle in with them. That was incredible brain food, just that time.
What age was this, Kirsten? Do you remember roughly what age this was you were doing the...
That's a great question. I was probably 3 or 4 because I remember being able to, my dad would put his knee, you know, he'd be laying flat, but he'd put his knees up and I could sit at the top of his knees and slide down his shin.
That's cute. Absolutely.
And I could do that over and over and over and over and over again. And that warmth and connection should not be underestimated. You know, that type of play, you know, we're kind of trained in our culture that there's something else more important that we should be doing, all these other things. You know, getting them out and doing this and doing that and showing them flashcards. And I'm a little appalled by the, you know, the teaching your infant to read programs. You know, the way to teach your infant to read is to be with them.
Right.
You know, and talk to them about their surroundings and, you know, notice what catches their eye and go with that. And
just one personal observation. One of my earliest memories as a child, I mean, I couldn't have been more than maybe 3, maybe 4, was my mother or my grandmother being in there on their lap, in their arms, and reading to me. And that made a huge impression. I've been, you know, I can't put down books. Here I am, 65, and I cannot put down a book now because it's just something that I grew up with.
Yeah. And it wasn't just reading, right? It was, I bet you can... You know, remember the sensation of her behind you. Am
Absolutely.
I right?
The scent of your mother. You can. It's probably, you know, it's the memory of the memory of the memory of the reality. But certainly that room, the whole ambience of being held very, very warmly and comfortingly in my, and specifically my grandmother's lap when she was would be reading to me, and I was in a, you know, again talking personally from a home without a dad at the time. My parents had divorced, so my mother and my grandmother and an extended family was very, I have to say, you know, talking about the 1950s, it's probably more instinctive than a learned approach, but it was all very, very, very supportive like that. At least that is my memory, and I think I turned out okay. Did I turn out okay, Laura? Yeah.
You turned out highly intelligent.
Sometimes I wonder, but... the extended family. I think that's in this day and age when so many families have both partners having to work and pursuing a career for both the man and the woman, the man and the wife. perhaps the extended family is something that can help. Any thoughts on that, Kirsten? I mean, grandmothers, grandparents, aunts, friends even that can help with the child, keeping that warm relationship with the child.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, it's the more the better. You know, it's like, if you know, we humans want and need lots of interaction with lots of people. Mm-hmm. You know, that the more children get of that warmth and that love, it's just kind of filling up their emotional bank account. And their emotional bank account is what builds their intelligence. You know, the safer we feel, the more trusting we feel of our environment, the more ready and able we are to learn. You know, we can access that frontal lobe, which has all those, you know, that logical component that I was describing. The safer we feel, the more ready and able we are to access that part of our brain, and that's where we learn really well.
But Kirsten, what do you do as a parent when you just haven't got it? When the kind of play that you were describing with the child just doesn't seem accessible to you. They're irritating you. You find that what they're doing is you're having difficulty connecting with them.
I'm so glad you asked that. And it's really important for parents, any parents that are listening to hear this, that is an incredibly common situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that and parents feel terrible about that. What's wrong with me? You know, the parents come to me and they feel terrible that they're like, well, I can't play with them and I don't know how, and it irritates the crud out of me. I don't want to do it. And you expect me to play with them when I feel like, you know, getting in the car and running away and never coming back. So they already feel bad in that way, and then they feel bad that they feel that way, and it turns into this sort of vicious cycle, because the worse we feel as parents, the harder it is to be relaxed and playful mm-hmm. and connected to our children. I mean, it really does create a vicious cycle. So any parent that's out there that's listening that has felt like that, I can't say enough how you are not alone. And what happens there, I think, George, is that we too have had those same hurts and upsets that I was describing that young children have. We've just had many, many more years of those hurts and upsets, and many, many, many times when we needed somebody to be there to let us heal those things, you know, have somebody whose shoulder we could cry on, or, you know, just be able to stomp our feet when we were really mad, or drive down the street yelling out the window to undo some of those hurts and upsets. Many, many times that did not happen for us. And
no.
So most of us walk around with a pretty sizable backlog of hurts and upsets. And those are the things that get in the way. It's not our children. You know, it looks like it's our children because they're the immediate person there that's needing our attention and love. So it kind of gets put on them as if it's their fault that it's hard. It is not them. It's these hurts and upsets, fears, stress, overwhelm. Most parents I know today are stressed and overwhelmed about money and about not having enough time. And all of those things are the things that keep us from being able to be flexible and playful and relaxed with our kids. So there also is a lot of hope there. And we need just what children need. We need a place where we can release emotions, feel safe. We need to be around people that we can connect with. And so what I really talk to parents about is really kind of building their support network, like having 5 or 6 people on your speed dial that at a moment's notice, when you're stressed and overwhelmed and you just feel like pulling your hair out, when your child has said the last thing they could possibly say to you that you can handle anymore, that you're wanting to aim your anger at them or you just want to shut down, instead of doing that, you call somebody on the phone and say, could you just listen to me for 5 minutes? Tell them not to give you any advice, not to jump in and say, hey, this is what I did when that happened, but really just full on listen to you and trust you. That you will, if you get to cry or rage or rant, that you'll be able to kind of unload enough tension and stress that you can go back and be a little more present with your child. So 5 or 6 minutes, 10 minutes really helps. I really recommend getting to have a couple people a week that can listen to you for at least 20 minutes at a time. And then you take a turn listening to them. That's really an ideal thing, and I talk about that's a listening partnership, and it's a really wonderful tool. You know, I do as much as 45 minutes at a time with people, where I listen to them for 45 minutes, they listen to me as a mom, not a parenting instructor person, but just as a mom. But I also think it's really good to have a few little instant emotional release things. And I've actually asked my children to help me with this because I want them to understand that when I'm getting upset or angry or I'm not relaxed, I'm not playful, when they see that tense look on my face, that it's not their fault. So I tell them, I'm having a hard time right now. I need to, you know, X, Y, Z. And I have a kind of a list, a laundry list of things I can do to get back on track. You know, I might go out in the backyard and kind of stomp around and make some loud noises for a while. I've asked parents before, some parents, this really works, they chunk eggs at trees. My kid's favorite is telling me to yell cowabunga. They love this one. And they'll say, come on, Mom, you need to say it. And I'll be like in this stuck spot. And I don't know. I don't want to. And they're like, Mom, say it, cowabunga. And they'll, first I'll say it kind of quietly. And they'll be like, no, you got to do better than that. And I'll end up, you know, having to say it two or three or four or five times till the point where I'm like hollering, cowabunga. If I'm driving, I roll down the window and they make me yell it out the window. And I will tell you something. There is really, as far as I know, there's virtually no way of doing that without, you know, having a smile on your face by the end of doing that.
It's sort of really laughing at yourself and realizing that you're human and you have to let it loose.
Yeah, and it's a Band-Aid. I mean, it's not the solution to everything. It's a temporary stopgap maneuver, you know, and my kids are aware of it, and that they have told me many times. They also know to tell me to call people. You know, Mom, I think it would be a good idea for you to call people. And I think, well, how, you know, different was that from my growing up that, you know, you could actually say, you know, in a loving way, Mom, you need to call somebody. They can tell. You know, my kids will say, Mom, you're making that face. They know.
Kirsten, we're going to have to take just a brief break again here at KPFT. And I'd mentioned that our guest on Thresholds this morning is Kirsten Nottelson from the very wonderful hand-in-hand workshops. And I'll remind our listeners that they can find out more about the hand-in-hand workshops at the website, which is www.handinhandworkshops.com. And Kirsten Nottelson will be back in just a moment. And also take some calls from our listeners here at KPFT. If you'd like to chip in with some questions for our guest, our phone number is 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. And I'm John Proffitt with George Ryder, and we'll be back in just a moment.
And this is Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. The time is 6:33. Here's a quick look at traffic and weather. There's a two-vehicle accident on I-10, Katy Freeway, westbound. That's outbound at Park 10. One main lane and one shoulder lane are affected. And there's slow traffic on 288 inbound from Beltway 8 to Airport. That travel time is about 6 minutes. The temperature is 75 degrees with a few clouds. Humidity is 94%. There's a 20% chance of showers. Today's high will be around 92 and low 75 degrees. Please stay tuned after Thresholds for the Jim Hightower commentary, followed by Democracy Now! At 7 o'clock and BBC News Hour at 8 o'clock. And now back to Thresholds with John Proffitt and George Ryder and their guest, Kirsten Nottelson.
Thank you, Laura. And we're back live here from Houston and KPFT. And this has been just an incredible conversation, Kirsten. But I'm going to do something right now. Just mention some of the titles of your workshops, which are in their own way quite provocative and give sort of an idea of the broad topics that you tackle with this issue of parents and parenting and raising children. Things like enhancing communication with your child through sign language. Wow. Smoothing out the toileting transition. That's a good way of putting it. Taking the bite out of biting. Here's a very, very big one. Keeping the romance while raising a family. These are all, obviously, we will never have enough time on the air to cover all of these, but it is a just a probably the single most important thing that that we as people, as human beings can do, i.e., you know, preparing the next generation and raising our own children to be as open and productive and unimpaired individuals as possible. You're doing a very, very important service by providing this kind of counseling and help. One topic that I would love to have you look at a little bit is the business of dealing with temper tantrums, taming tantrums, helping you and your child weather the storm of strong emotions. I know that's probably some of the most traumatic things that parents have to do is deal with a child that does have a temper tantrum, and how do you deal with it?
Yeah, this is a big one for parents, huge for parents. And part of why it's so hard is that we've been trained in our society that, you know, crying and strong emotions are somehow a bad thing or they're somehow misbehavior. And first of all, if we can kind of shift that thinking to recognizing a temper tantrum as an unloading of those hurts, because that is exactly what's happening when a child is having a big, huge temper tantrum, that they are, you know, releasing stored up, pent up frustration. And if we can learn to, we don't have to give in, you know, quote unquote, give in to what it is that they're asking. So say, for example, the temper tantrum is, you know, started by, you know, they're asking for that cookie before they've had dinner. And in our home, we've decided, no, you have to have your, you know, your healthy food before you have the cookie. So this parent has kind of set a limit of, you know, no, you can't have that cookie, and the child launches into a huge upset.
If I were faced with broccoli before the cookie, I think I might have a tantrum too, you know?
Yeah. So there's lots of things along the way that children have these really big upsets about, right?
Yeah.
It can be the cookie. It can be something that's completely rational. I mean, sometimes it's things that, you know, a child has a huge temper tantrum about, you want them to put shoes on, and they're about to walk on hot pavement. You know, there's things that are completely rational, and that's part of what's really baffling for parents is sometimes it's something that doesn't even, a parent has a hard time even understanding why the child's upset about it. It's even something a child likes. Or, we've had this lovely day together where the child has been connected and playing with the parent and, you know, now it's time to put on your green coat instead of your blue coat, and the child has a huge upset. And the parent is often baffled because we want to solve it and we want to figure out why. A lot of times we cannot figure out why. What we can know is that when a child is unloading with a big load of hurts and upsets like that, that's what it's going to look like. It might look like a child, you know, dropping to the floor and flailing, big tears. What we can do is drop down ourselves to our knees or to whatever eye level they're at and hold the limit. No, sweetie, I'm not going to let you have that cookie. But then let the feelings come. Let them unload. It's kind of it's a cleansing, healing process. We don't have to give in to what they're asking for. You know, we can still say, yes, you have to have your seatbelt on, sweetie, when we're driving in the car. No, I'm not going to let you walk on the pavement without your shoes because it's hot pavement. No, you cannot have the cookie. We can still hold the limit in a firm, calm, clear voice. But I think when parents understand, oh, this is just them doing some healing work, when they get to clear some of this emotional baggage out, I'm going to have a more rational, calm, playful, relaxed child on the other side. The parent, And once they've done that a few times with their child and they see what it looks like on the other side, parents tend to go, oh, wow, that was great. I'm going to listen to them more often. And they tend to be able to be a little bit more relaxed about those tantrums. What's hard for many parents about this is their own backlog of what happened to them when they cried really hard when they were young.
Yeah,
you know, many of us were said, you better stop crying, or I'll give you something to cry about, or we were hit because we cried, right. or we were, you know, scolded or humiliated or embarrassed because we cried. So those feelings come up in us when our children have these big feelings. So again, if we can, you know, go to a listening partnership and unload some of our feelings about what comes up when our child cries, we tend to be able to be more relaxed and present for our children when they're making use of that healing process that can look very messy and very sloppy and, you know, be uncomfortable for us.
Sure, very uncomfortable. I think, Kristen, we're going to take a telephone call. We have Johnny standing by from Lamarck. And, Johnny, do you have a question for our guest?
Actually, I have five items I want to quickly mention, one after the other, and tie them into a concept of mine. The first one is a lot of suburbs, the way they're designed, is to keep families separate. And you have to be proactive in approaching your neighbors for help if you're a young mother who's having a lot of issues with time management and having to take care of the family, and you're by yourself, you feel isolated, and you feel like you have no adults to talk to. So I think we need to make more people aware of reaching out. That's one. The next one is this public service announcement I see on TV, mostly on free speech TV and alternative media, not so much in mainstream, where it's a father, a young father, who goes up to the baby crib while he's trying to watch, I guess, a game on TV. The baby's crying because the baby wants attention. The baby feels maybe scared or bored or whatever, and he reaches to the baby. After he shouts to the baby, stop, that's enough, that's enough. The baby doesn't understand, so he goes over and picks up the baby and shakes the baby. So you've got traumatic injury there. And then you've got a lot of issues that involve taking care of people in the early chapters of life are very, very similar to taking care of people in their final chapters of life, you know, nursing home care. And then the other two are nuns and then gas furnaces. And the gas furnace issue for me, when I was like 3 or 4 years old in our first apartment in Brooklyn, scared the hell out of me. I didn't know what it was. And that goes to the issue of parents not being fully in tune with their child's fears. Your guest explained that very well. Mm-hmm. And all this comes down to, the nuns, is also had a fear of going to school early on because I felt the nuns were inhuman and I was afraid of being physically hit, although that only happened to me once or twice, but I was afraid constantly because of the fact other kids next to me got hit. So we have a big issue in our country of teaching grade school kids about childhood development as if that's something that they're not entitled or that they can't handle. We treat them with kid gloves. They can't hear about reality of the world. You know, animals eating animals is something that they should only see when they're, 8 or 9 years old on Discovery Channel. So I want to know your author's thoughts about this. And is there talk about reformulating some of what we teach kids in grade school?
Very, very good, Johnny. Thanks for your questions. And Kirsten, did you get those different topics he was touching on?
So I'm just trying to get the question. Is the question about what are we doing or should we be doing
yes.
in school to teach children about child development, or was there a bigger question than that?
Well, I think the question behind the question also was this reference to the fact that there's so many instances in this in today's society where kids encounter something, and I use the air quotes here, discipline. Johnny mentioned being hit and being fearing being hit while he was even in school, and obviously a parochial school at the time. So I think there are several issues here that
let me interject,
go ahead,
a little, John. What I see as a really just sort of overwhelming unstated assumption is that somehow you need to punish children in order to get them to behave properly. And certainly corporal punishment is one version of that, but there are others. Time out, for instance, sending children off to their room is really a punishment. And I'd like to hear what Kirsten thinks about that in terms of how we raise children.
Using punishment as an incentive or disincentive, suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when you think of that model that I was describing as, like, why children go off track, when I say off track, it's what the common language is, we call it misbehaving. But when they go off track, it's like when they're not making good choices or they're not being able to do what we're asking them to do. So punishment, which is usually harsh, scolding, degrading, isolate, you know, timeout I think is a better alternative than spanking. I'm glad we figured that part out. But sending a child away is further isolating them. And when children are, you know, doing off-track behavior, they're already disconnected. Mm-hmm. You know, they already aren't emotionally connected. So putting them away from us, away from others, doesn't help them get reconnected. It doesn't help their logical brain come online. And when he said witnessing other children, the fear of even witnessing other children being hurt,
yes,
we're very empathic. You know, we care about other human beings. So that fear of seeing, you know, I've talked to a lot of parents who have a lot of trauma for them that looks like being physically hurt and abused, but they tell me time and time again, I didn't get hit. Well, then after working with them for a while, they finally reveal or realize that they watch their siblings being hit a lot.
Right.
And they learn to be, you know, the quote-unquote good kid. But the trauma came in the same way, as if because they had so much fear, not only for themselves of potentially getting hurt, but, you know, this person that they cared about very much being hurt. Or you'll also hear about this from people that grew up and their parent was being abused. Maybe they never got hit, but they watched their mother or father being abused.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very traumatic. And it doesn't work well. It just shut that fear, just shut down our thinking.
Sure.
And when our thinking is shut down, we're going to have off-track behavior.
Kirsten, I think you also touched on, by mentioning that fear, I think the most unfortunate thing in many respects is a young child who is immersed in a family with conflict. If the mother and father or the adults in that home are abusive verbally or otherwise to themselves, what kind of a message could that possibly send to a small child?
Mm-hmm. It's scary. It's confusing. It's, you know, these are the people that they're supposed to be able to trust and feel safe with so they can go out. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that child will grow up and become somebody who abuses others or is harmful or aggressive to others. But it is going to affect the way that they operate in the world. It is going to have an impact on them, whether it's limiting the bigness of their life. You know, they might have areas that they just can't fully express and be themselves, be the whole person that they're intended to be. It's going to impact them.
Sure. I might mention quickly that we probably have time for one more phone call. Our number here at KPFT is 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. Our guest on Thresholds is Kirsten Nottelson with the Hand in Hand Workshops, and we're talking about raising children and all of the trials, tribulations, and the joys, and especially the joys of child rearing.
Mm.
Some of the positive things you've touched on, Kirsten, have just struck such a what's the word I'm looking for here? Such a resonant link with me. Thinking about the things in my own childhood that I can remember made such a difference. The idea of having the extended family is something you mentioned that people have to work on. And our previous caller, Johnny, mentioned that that was a great difficulty in our spread out suburban environment, finding the resources to tap into that extended family. You have any thoughts on the really difficult problems that our modern suburban life have added to the whole process of child rearing?
Yeah, absolutely. I loved that first point that he made about how our neighborhoods are set up for us to be separate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live in a neighborhood that has very, very few children, and the few that we have are inside most of the time. I think they're playing video games I'm pretty sure.
another isolating phenomenon. Another isolating phenomenon where the kids are, you know, just sort of retreating into an inner world of the video games rather than interacting with the real world.
Yeah, and then you have parents that, you know, somebody referred to both parents oftentimes being away at work, and so the children that are home maybe are, you know, told to stay inside to be safe because mom and dad aren't home right now. Or they're in aftercare, and then by the time the parents get home, they're having to, you know, get dinner on the table, get children bathed, get homework done, and get to bed, and then get up and do the next thing. And then there's also just, you know, one of the things that happens with parents, where we live in a society where parents seem to be free, what am I trying to say? Sort of their criticisms of parents and parenting, it seems to be perfectly acceptable. And so parents become, you know, more and more isolated in terms of they don't want to show where they struggle. They don't want to show where it's hard because they're worried about what's going to happen.
They're being very defensive, sure.
You know, I work with women who are in, you know, drug treatment facilities, and they are really, really struggling, and they're terrified to say how hard they're struggling because they have Child Protective Services right looking over their shoulder.
I mean, literally looking over their shoulder.
Literally. And so I try to make in my classes a really safe environment, like this is a place that you can talk about what's going on. And they really need to because they've got generations of this backlog that I'm describing that makes it hard for them to parent. This backlog of hurts and upsets, and racism has slammed them, poverty has slammed them, classism has slammed them, you know, and they've got all these struggles to wade through to be able to parent the way they want to parent, and they can't talk about how hard it is. They're terrified to talk about how hard it is.
Hmm.
That's that isolating thing that he described of, like, the mother that wants to reach out and, you know, we're not set up. You know, fortunately, I will say, we are learning. You know, things are changing. People are starting to think about setting up neighborhoods where there's a common space and people play. You know, going to the park's important. You know, we're having more parks developed in our town, and, you know, that's exciting. You know, things are shifting. We are learning.
George?
Kirsten, one of the things that occurred to me, and certainly when I grew up, the day began when we went out in the street and found other children to play with, and then we organized a game and we played, at least when we weren't going to school. And what you're talking about now is beginning to create spaces where that can occur. What's the importance of play with other children in the development of ourselves?
Oh, play is a time when you get to kind of relax and, you know, create and imagine, make up rules, argue, you know, resolve conflict. I'm running a summer camp, the Parkour Plus summer camp, and, you know, we play these games, and it's so fascinating to me. Like, we have a game, you know, we might have the game Capture the Flag, right? Well, all these kids are coming from all different parts of our town, and they all have their own rules. This is how we play it. And there's so much there to be learned about, like, how do you resolve that conflict when one person says, if you do this, you're out, and the other person says, no, you're not out if you do that. They get to learn so much. They get to run really hard. They get to fully be in their bodies. And there's so much of our life in society now where they don't get to just be fully in their bodies, fully in their thinking. The young people get to be in charge when they're playing games. There's not an adult saying, this is how you do it. This is how you need to sit. This is how long you need to sit. You know, it's like they get to be in charge. They get to use their minds. They get to use their voices. They get to, you know, imagine, try new things, take risks. All of those things are so essential to building, you know, intelligence and self-esteem and human connection and laughter and learning how to be around other people. And it's just, you know, it's rich, 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 rich food for their bodies and brains, play is.
It seems a little ironic that some of our classic literature paints such a dystopic view of childhood games, things like Lord of the Flies or Catcher in the Rye. I mean, I just hearing you describe that, which is certainly my experience, but that I go being asked to read in high school and college some literature considered to be classic that looks on the quote bad side unquote of childhood. That's kind of an odd perspective for society to have.
That's layers and generations of hurt without the healing happening, I think.
Yes, indeed. Well, George, any closing questions for Kirsten? We're just about to the end of the, we've got about 3 minutes remaining,
anything that can be done to sort of pull children, I assume that you feel that this preoccupation with video games, which even when, I guess when you're, it is an interactions, well, many of them are actually live interactions with other children who are also sitting in front of a computer. Do you think that that's something that we really ought to somehow pull the children out of, that there's some value in that? If you do think that we should pull them out of it, how do you do that?
Oof, that's a doozy, George.
It is a doozy.
Having a 7 and 13-year-old boy in my home, it's a doozy, and I'm working on figuring it out every day. I think we've got some adjusting to do about our thinking about this technology. And, you know, what I do know is that anything a child is doing that's off track, the first thing we need to do is meet them where they're at. You know, I don't have all the answers to that, but I think that if we can learn to kind of join them in that world in some ways, that helps us connect and help figure out how to, you know, I think we're going to be able to be more of a partnership with them about having opening conversations with them about what makes sense. How much time does it make sense for you to be playing these games? What kinds of games does it make sense for you to be playing? How do you feel? How does this affect you when you play these games? I think that if we can somehow join in with them on those games, we're more likely to be able to reach them and have real dialogue with them and come up with limits that make sense. I don't have the perfect answer. I think we're all trying to figure out how to, you know, this technology is in their lives much differently than it was in our lives, dramatically differently than it wasn't in our lives at all.
Exactly. Something brand new to deal with. Kirsten, I want to thank you for being with us this morning. We are out of time on Thresholds this morning. Kirsten Nottelson, the Hand in Hand Workshops, their website is handinhandworkshops.com. Kirsten, thank you again for being our guest this morning. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear your thoughts on early childhood development.
Well, thank you so much. I loved being here, and such a great show. I love that you guys do this and open up these topics for discussion. So thank you.
You're quite welcome. And George, thank you for coming in via telephone. George Ryder by phone from his summer home. John Prophet here in the studios at KPFT Houston. Thanks for being with us on Thresholds for this Thursday morning.
Just for the hell of it, let's reimagine Walmart. Imagine if the world's most profitable retailer were to invest a tiny piece of its corporate bottom line in a global effort to elevate its human moral line. And imagine if Walmart did this by committing to a sincere, enforceable, legally binding effort to ensure that its thousands of garment workers will no longer die in hellish factory fires and collapses of shoddily constructed sweatshops. Also, let's imagine that the corporation's executives reached out to union leaders and workers' rights advocates to help make this safety effort more than a PR puff piece. Oh, one more. Imagine that the executives and the multi-billionaire owners of Walmart felt good about this little gesture of common decency, maybe even took pride in it. But no, that wouldn't be Walmart, would it? Yet, while the retail giant flatly refuses to be part of it, such an effort at real reform is being made. Some 70 clothing chains, mostly major European stores, are having about 1,000 Bangladeshi factories that make apparel for them thoroughly checked by independent fire and safety inspectors. Working with unions and government officials, every dangerous facility will be immediately shut down. The companies will be responsible for financing safety renovations, and they will pay workers while their factories are closed for repair. Walmart, Gap, Target, most other big American chains that profit enormously from the old slipshod factory system have pig-headedly rejected the comprehensive safety plan as too costly. Instead, trying the PR approach, they'll soon propose a voluntary, non-binding paint-and-patch safety scheme. This is Jim Hightower saying, just once, just one time, couldn't Walmart do something just because it's right? Who knows? Doing the right thing might even prove profitable.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out.